Welcome to the Home Tech Podcast Show, number 34, June 16th, 2011. I am your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live on Ustream from the Average Guy Studios here in Sunny, and it is beautifully sunny today, but in Bellevue, Nebraska, and posted each week at theaverageguy.tv. You can contact the show by sending us an email at podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Follow me on Twitter. We do all the show announcements, show times, and changes. Just follow me at Jay Collison. You can find us on Facebook just by searching The Average Guy Podcast. A couple of the regulars back tonight, and of course, we always have a special guest. I'll introduce Christian Johnson first. Christian is the man behind BIOS-Mods and now the fixer of EX485 Windows Home servers. Christian, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing great, guys. This week on the plate was indeed the resurrection of the one-year bricked HP MediaSmart.
Now, how did you brick that thing to begin with?
I was one of the testers trying to write a updated BIOS that would support the dual-core and quad-core CPUs with the newer revision steppings for people to put in new CPUs into their motherboard. And I got into the point where I flashed the BIOS for the 490. And that was the one that had the dual core support, and that worked fine, except the fan control functions were missing. So I tried to insert those back in for the 485, and the BIOS died.
Ooh.
And I had known when I had gone into it that there was a recovery method for AMI that lets you restore a corrupted BIOS off your USB drive, and I couldn't get it to work for the life of me. And then I finally just kind of dawned on me this week, you know, maybe there's something I had to miss. So I went back, I rechecked that the file name was amiboot.rom. And it turns out that if you don't put the server into recovery mode within literally a quarter of a second of it being on, and then do the control home keyboard function to initiate the sequence for recovery off the USB, it won't do it at all. So it was a lot of tampering with – it was kind of like orchestrating the proper order for getting it to read off the USB. But once it did, it restored within like 5 seconds.
Nice.
It was back up.
Now, what kind of prompted you – it's been bricked for a year. So what kind of prompted you all of a sudden to come back to it to try it again?
It was collecting dust on the shelf.
All right. And school was out and you had some time.
Right.
Is what you're saying. All right. Well, congratulations on getting that done. I know you posted that fix over at bios-mods.com, and if folks have tried that before, probably not too many of our listeners brick their it's the 45s, right?
Yeah.
But you're
the solution applies to any BIOS that gets messed up on a MediaSmart.
Well, good. If you're wondering what we're talking about, head over there, bios-mods.com. And Christian wrote up an article early this week, so congratulations on getting that thing fixed. We also have tonight Andrew Morris. Andrew is our international correspondent. There, yeah. I've been mixing up words. I meant to say immigration, and I said migration, and that doesn't work very well. But Andrew,
I can be the international immigrant if you want me to.
You don't have any problem getting into the United States when you do. When was the last time you were here in the U.S.?
Last time I was in the U.S., they told me I hadn't left when I got there. So I did have some problems getting in last time around, but that's another story for a different podcast.
All right. Well, welcome from Melbourne, Australia. We also have with us tonight our guest and special feature guest, Gordon Schmidt. Gordon hangs out and hangs around the Home Server Show community, and he's been on the show a couple times with us. Gordon, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Hi, everyone.
What, Gordon, from a technology perspective, what's keeping you busy these days? What are you working on?
Mostly work.
you got to say that for your employer, right? But besides work, what are you doing at home?
Outside of that, I did upgrade my Windows Home Server to 2011, and then I've been working with my two younger brothers and my brother-in-law on a little project we spun up to work through the Windows Home Server 2011 SDK and to develop an add-in that would pull server performance and some of the other things we'd like to see right on the main console page.
Oh, very cool. And are you full production Windows Home Server 2011 at this point? I mean, your data is out there and...
Yep.
Really? All right. Very good. How's the performance been so far? You feel pretty comfortable with it?
Yeah, the performance is great. The I don't know what it was, if Drive Extender missing or what, but the media streaming DVDs through the Xbox and stuff seems to be way smoother and no lag, and audio syncs with the video good. And
yeah. Well, no, this won't make a lot of sense to folks who don't have a home server, but yeah. How did you set up, what did you do about your hard drive storage space? Just
Basically got the OS drive, no mirror, just a single drive. It fails. I just drop a new drive in there and recover from the backup.
Sure.
And then the critical data is on a software mirror, 1 terabyte drives.
Okay.
And everything else is on a 2 terabyte drive, and then I back up to a IOSafe solo.
An IOSafe solo, which you won.
I did.
Right? On the home server show.
Yep.
Very nice.
I was lucky.
Very nice. Is that the 1 terabyte one?
That's the
1.5. Yeah, you know, that IOSafe, we haven't talked about that in a while, but those, you know, those, of course, are fireproof, waterproof. External
bulletproof
USB.
To you guys too.
Yeah, well, sort of bulletproof. They'll take a couple shotgun blasts before they go. Not really designed to be bulletproof, but we took them to the firing range at CES and will not withstand an AR-15 or an M16 round. By the way, as we at 30, I think we're at about 30 yards or 30 meters, and
we shouldn't see any of those around the home.
Bullet went clean through. No, you shouldn't, unless you're taking it out or you're in combat. You shouldn't have that problem, but. That IOSafe, you know, whether you're this is kind of a good average guy tip, you know, with an IOSafe drive, fireproof, waterproof, pretty much any would cover anything that could happen inside your house if it burned down for the most part. It will protect your data, close up on itself, and save that hard drive if something were to go wrong. So if you are doing backup and you don't have a Windows home server or you don't have any kind of regular backup, you might want to check out this iosafe.com. And no, this is not an. They're not paying us. Maybe they should.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say they're not paying us, but you can get it. Before the home server show, before I'd heard it on there and you guys talk about it and stuff, I never really paid attention to it. Maybe saw it on the shelf at Best Buy or passed by, but never even thought about it or anything. But it really does. I mean, it's if you don't want to do offsite and you're nervous about doing offsite backup, that'd be the way to go in home.
Right. Yeah. A simple solution. It's about twice as big as a regular external hard drive. Costs about twice as much. I hate to say that because the pricing may be a little bit cheaper now, but yeah. Does protect that drive from fire and water, and is a very, very easy on a scale of 1 to 5 on the average guy difficulty meter. It's a 1. I mean, it just works like a regular external hard drive. So a good way if you're not currently backing your stuff up. And you want to protect yourself against, you know, fire or water damage in case your house burns down. It's a great way to do it. So, good stuff. Well, Gordon, welcome to the podcast, guys. I know it's been a busy week for everybody, and it seems like summer started, and we all thought maybe we'd go on vacation, but only Christian gets to take a summer vacation, and he's busy doing tech projects. Christian, hey, what are your? I know we're a week into vacation for you. What's a couple projects you got lined up for the summer at this point?
Yeah, a lot of what I've been working on to kind of get it out of the way so I can do some more developing and coding is I have a couple local groups in the Western New York area that have kind of asked me to help facilitate their IT needs and their website administration. So a lot of what I did this week was sitting in board meetings and trying to find out what people wanted, which translated to cracking out the PHP, MySQL, and JavaScript book and writing them an encrypted SQL database that would store pretty much all their data about the organization so that it's easy for them to access and that different departments can use their manager software so that they communicate with each other all through the same email and then have their synchronized calendars through the same company website name. So that's translated not only a lot of communication verbally, but a lot of PHP coding that has slipped away in the last couple months.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like you got a busy summer ahead of you. Yeah. From that standpoint. Speaking of summer, a couple things here at theaverageguy.tv that we are thinking about. One is there's a home server show meetup in Madison or the Madison area. Not this weekend, but next. It's the 24th. So if you're listening to this and you don't currently listen to the home server show, I will be out at that meetup. And if you need some information on that, you can head over to thehomeservershow.com. You'd be welcome to come out and join us on the meetup. Gordon, I know you're going to try and make it, right? We're going to see you there.
Yep, I'm coming and hopefully bringing one, if not two people along with me. So
Yeah.
Should be good.
Yeah, perfect. And a reminder to you two guys, maybe Gordon will jump in as well. I'm actually going to try and do a home tech podcast live from that meetup on Saturday the 24th. So the three of us will try and coordinate a time, probably later or maybe the latest slot in the afternoon so that we can catch Andrew early on Sunday morning. Christian, that'd be Saturday afternoon the 24th, if you can take a peek. At that, first time I've asked you guys about that. But we'll try and do some live podcasting and try and do a live show maybe that Saturday and talk about some stuff we've done for the home server show. So watch for the announcements via Twitter and some of those things, and we will try and get that done. All right, let's jump into the show. Gordon, I know you've got some things that you'd like to cover. Why don't you go ahead and get started?
Yeah, so I just had a couple things that I use on a daily basis just to keep me going and make things a little more efficient. The first one is a Chrome to Phone extension. It's specifically for Android phones, and you have to have a ROM of 2.2 or higher. But what it does is you could be surfing a web page on your PC or your laptop and hit this Chrome to Phone button within the Chrome browser. It will automatically take that web page you're browsing, dump it right to your phone instantly. So that's kind of neat and
so,
nice.
So walk me through that again. So I'm on the web page to start.
Yeah.
With, right?
So say you're on the AverageGuy.tv, and you're reading an article, and you've got to go, but you want to keep reading it. You can, if you have this extension installed, you can click on the Chrome to Phone extension button within Chrome. It'll automatically move it right and open up the browser right in your phone.
And I get that from the Chrome store. Is that right? Is that
yep. If you go to if you go in your Chrome browser to the little wrench and you go down to Tools and then Extensions,
okay,
and then just search for it.
Okay, so it'll just basically push, and then I have to download an app on my phone as well. That's
correct.
Waiting for that to come in. And then that would just automatically transfer over to my phone. Can I load those pages up? Can I send 4, 5, 6 pages to it to my phone?
Oh yeah,
have it ready. Okay.
Yep. Oh. If you have them there, you can also choose it to open them up right in the browser, or you can have it just save an icon shortcut to it right on your phone's screen.
Okay.
So you can tag it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. If you want to just send them over there, you know, especially if you want to reference it, you know, you're going to want to reference it, and you're not going to be at your PC, and you want to reference it on your phone. Does the extension, does that page stay there until I read it, or does it go away at some point?
No, it'll stay up. So if you were to send it to your phone and then say hours go past before you check your phone, when you turn it back on, it'll still be there.
All right. So that's a pretty easy solution to get web pages to your phone if you're not wanting to get – because I know sometimes it's hard, at least on my Android. I have an Epic and a pretty big screen. And getting two web pages sometimes can be kind of cumbersome. So you could – be surfing and maybe a couple pages you've and we'll talk a little bit more about this. Maybe you've found some things in your RSS feed. You want to read them later. You could just tag that in the extension, send that over to your phone and read it on the train or the plane or whatever, right?
Exactly.
I assume you have to have internet connection on the phone to pull those back up then once you're...
Once they load. So if you say you had a Wi-Fi only, you didn't have a 3G data roaming plan, if the page loads, it's cached on your phone. So you'd be able to... You'd be able to take it with you and screen that, but you won't be able to click on any links or go down into it further.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds pretty helpful and pretty easy to do.
Yeah.
I would think. You know, when we were looking at the show notes and you said phone extension, one of the things I was thinking about, also kind of an easy average guy thing that not a lot of folks know about, I think, is you can make phone calls right out of Gmail, right? I mean, so go down to the chat window, bottom left-hand corner of any Gmail web page. You don't have to have a client. You don't have to install anything. Just go down to the bottom left-hand corner, and there's a little icon that says phone call. Just click on that, and a dial pad will appear in the right-hand corner for most people, I think, of their screen. Local calls, right, are free out of the U.S.
Yep.
Now, I don't know how this works.
Only.
Andrew, I don't know how it works for you guys making calls out of Australia. Have you tried that that feature in Gmail? Is that available to you guys?
It comes up as an option, but depending on how you're connecting to the internet, it's available or it isn't. So if I connect through a proxy at work that goes through the U.S., then I can. Okay. If I'm at home, it's a bit hit and miss.
Okay. So that might be U.S. origin or originating. The call must originate from the U.S. only?
Yeah, sometimes my ISP allows it and sometimes it doesn't. So I think it depends which part of their global proxy network they go through.
Okay.
Because most of our ISPs go across any one of about three links out to the continental US. So it really depends which link they're on at the time, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know... go ahead, Gordon.
If you could just get rid of the ISPs.
Yeah.
Well, we can't live without those guys, right? We can't live without those guys. I think for me, one of the applications for that I don't do enough of, so I'm down here, I've totally embraced Skype as a communications client at this point. I'm either talking on it or texting on it or both, and multiple people all at the same time as of late. And but my mom is not on Skype, nor do I necessarily want her on Skype. She still has a dial-up, and I don't really want her out there. And I don't call her enough. And I just need to, you know, while I'm down here, I got the headset on. I could just put her in there and call her up and do voice over IP, and nobody pays for the call. So not time, no minutes off my cell phone plan, although I never run into problems with that. But so if you didn't know, that's another super easy average guy tip. That phone you can dial right within. Now, of course, you have to have a microphone on your computer to use it. So but most laptops, if you bought them in the last year, have both a camera and a phone and a microphone built into it. So it'll probably just pop up, and start ringing. You can talk to anybody. Andrew, I think it's like 3 cents a minute for me to call you. I would never do that because Skype is free. But if I called you through this, I think it's 2 or 3 cents a minute to Australia. So pretty good rates.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good value. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never tried an international call on that. Maybe at some point. Well, I don't know how they bill you.
It calls Google to Google too, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Google Chat. And so we could be doing this all on Google Chat. In fact, that's our backup plan, guys. If Skype ever goes down, go to Gmail and we would do the show because we record independent of Skype now. I don't use, I use Audacity as opposed to Pamela, which Pamela is the Skype recording software. Audacity, another freeware tool that you can use to record audio. We can use any client that we can either do voice or video. Now, Google does not allow multiple video clients. So there's still point-to-point, but we could all come in on audio chat and get that done. So good stuff.
Gordon, I believe on Google Chat, it also, if you have Google Voice set up where you can assign and pick a phone number to go, it will actually use that rather than just using an anonymous one. So you can have people actually call you back on it, even if they're not using Google Chat, and it'll still come through to you.
I just recently used my Google Voice number for, which was really cool because I was able to get a Google Voice number that was just one number off from my cell phone. So it's really easy to remember. My cell phone number starts with a 5. My Google Voice number starts with a 4. But when we sold our van recently, instead of putting my cell phone number out there, I put my Google Voice number. And the messages, you know, so I could take advantage of the Google Voice messaging, and that comes in both email, and you can listen to the, you know, the recording of it. And it's amazing how good that voice recognition is as those voice messages come across via email.
Yeah, I was going to say that's exactly what I set up Google Voice for initially, was to sell some things on Craigslist because I don't want to hand out my phone number and I don't just want to have an email address for people to reach me at.
Yeah.
So I set that up, and when people call you back to your Google Voice number, it also references sometimes the city and state that they're calling from. Mm-hmm. So you get a little extra information you wouldn't normally get.
Either of you guys use, Christian, Andrew, either of you guys use Google Voice yet?
No, I haven't used the Google Voice, but actually one thing that I noticed on my account is that it kind of advertises the point you can call landlines for free and call numbers for free. I don't know if that includes cell phones or not, but...
Yeah, I imagine it would, and of course that's not a feature of Skype, right? If you're going to pay to call in a landline out of Skype, but Google Voice, it's a free deal. I was in a meeting, I was at work and I was in a meeting and a guy was on a Mac and he brought up, Gmail. And we were talking about somebody goes, well, let's just call him. And he just dialed it right there, and we did a conference call right off his laptop. So a pretty cool little productivity tool. And the sound was just dynamite. I mean, it was the sound quality was amazing. It was much better than if he would have tried to take a cell phone, dial the number, put it on speaker. That just worked a whole bunch better.
Yeah. I think we're still limited based on geography. I don't think Google's footprint is big enough for us down here yet. Okay. When I go into Google Voice, it tells me that I can make free calls to the US, but again, I haven't tried, so maybe that's something we can try at a later date.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe we'll try and do the show one time via Google Voice as opposed to Skype, and we'll see what the quality's like.
Yeah.
See if that's possible. So, good stuff. Gordon, you've also got a note here about the free app of the day at Amazon. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think it was 2 months ago now, about 2.5 months ago, Amazon opened up an Android marketplace. It mirrors the actual Google Android marketplace, but there's one thing they do that Google doesn't, and that is they give away a free app of the day. So every day there's a free paid app that's out there, and I just created a Google calendar item for myself every morning when I get up, just hop out to the page, grab the app regardless of what it is. If you do it through the web page, you can actually click on it. It won't install on your device, so if you didn't really want it at the time, you don't have to install it and use it. But then you can always reference back in and sign into your account, and you can download it anytime. And that works if you're moving from your current phone to a new phone. There is a little bit of a bug in it that some people have figured out where if I had the Amazon App Store client installed on my phone and was installing applications, sideloading applications from the Amazon App Store, and I signed in my account to Jim's Android phone, he would actually be able to access all my applications that are sitting in my account. So.
Gordon, let's talk when we're at the meetup. Could you just look at my phone for a second?
I could just take it for a second.
Well, those are all free apps, right? You're not necessarily in that.
No, they're free paid apps,
right? Yeah,
yeah.
Does that work through the Google Store?
They had Tweetcaster, is it? Was one of the later ones they had, and they Watchdog is the one that's out there right now. That's a good paid application. So,
how much is that one?
$4.99. I'm sorry, $3.49 is what they have it on.
I know. Well, Andrew, you had a question. What was that? Do you remember your question?
Oh, that is one of the really nice things about the Google platform, isn't it? From a phone perspective, if you have to reset it or something, you just log back in and everything comes back down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And well, that doesn't automatically come down from the App Store. It remembers what you've bought, but
out of the market. Yeah.
It doesn't just drop. At least my experience was last time I'm on 2.2 Froyo. I had to still go in there and select the ones that I've downloaded before. If I've paid for them, then they're free again, right? They'll come down again. Mm. If they're free, of course they're free. But it just doesn't flush, which is kind of nice because if you know the sins of the past, right? If you downloaded a whole bunch of crappy free apps to your phone, it gives you kind of a chance to reset and start over.
Yeah, and there's applications that do allow what Andrew was talking about where it can just push them down. Like AppBrain is one that I use. I upgraded from or flashed my phone from 2.1 to 2.2. I used AppBrain and went to their webpage, said, okay, I've got my phone, I've synced it, installed the application on my phone. I hit the button on the webpage, and it automatically just starts downloading everything I had on before my phone.
All right, so that's an app that monitors and tracks the apps that you're downloading?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, all right. And that's a free one too, or that's
paid? That is free, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty nice. Well, that would be a handy backup. Is it only the apps that you've installed since you've installed that app, or does it scan for all apps and keep track of that?
Yeah, it scans. It scans what would be equivalent in a PC from your ad remove program. So.
Okay. So that's a pretty easy – I mean if you're an average user, that's a pretty easy way to kind of keep track of all the apps that you have on your phone and then get them back if for some reason you had to blow your phone away.
Yep.
Apps Brain, is that what it's called?
It's called App Brain.
App A-P-P-Brain. Brain. I'll have to give that a look.
Yeah. You can share, and then I also use it to share all the applications I have on my phone with other people. So if somebody just gets an Android and I'm talking to them about it, and they're asking me what applications are good, I just reference them right to my account, my public account on that web page, and then they can go and install them right from my page if they want.
All right. So it's just a nice way of having recommendations for what you're currently running. Oh, pretty cool.
The other thing I forgot to mention, I had said the word sideload.
Yeah.
In there, and that gets some people don't know what that means. And I think Sprint, Verizon, T-Mobile all allowed sideloading. That's where you download an application directly off the web, either off your phone or off a web page on your computer, and you can download it in, meaning that it's not in the Android market. AT&T is the only one I know that doesn't allow that, and they've come out with information that says they're working on it and going to start allowing it because they realize the value that it has in the Android space.
Is using the Android marketplace technically sideloading then? Or is that the App Store?
Yeah. So the Amazon App Store is sideloading.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know for those Amazon users. Christian, have you dropped your Winmo phone yet?
No, I still have it. And, you know, the only reason I do is because it does everything I need it to right now. I mean, it still has the same HTC Sense that all the Droid phones has. And most of the apps that you can get on an Android store, I mean, are pre-built into this phone. So I wouldn't really trade it right now because it integrates with Outlook, which the Android HTC Sync has been crashing. My dad's Outlook, he can't get Outlook to open anymore whenever HTC Sync is trying to sync his Evo to his computer. So that program's turned out to be a bust. So for the Windows compatibility side of it and the fact that it does everything I need it to do, there's really no point in me upgrading right now.
Christian, you're a little bit of an enigma there, to be honest, because you're content. It works. It's an old piece of hardware, and you're not willing to upgrade just to get the newest thing. I mean, that's pretty unusual, no. I think, for how long have you had that phone?
I've had this a little bit over a year now, probably. Oh, okay. It's a
so
2-year-old phone.
It's not too old. It's not too old.
It's got Winmo 6.5 on it, so before the whole Windows Phone 7 craziness. So.
All right. Well, very cool. Yeah. I guess that works. Gordon, a couple weeks ago we had talked about, I think, or maybe it was just last week, they all start to blend together after a while. We had talked a little bit about RSS feed readers, and I saw here you had a note about using Google Reader.
Yeah, so it's probably about 4 years ago when I started using Google Reader, but I used to go to, like I'm a lot of people I talk to, I used to go to each and every individual web page that I wanted to look at, scroll through the web page to read things, and it took a lot of time, and I was maybe, you know, eating up an hour looking at, you know, 5 web pages, where I started using Google Reader, and now I've got thousands of websites that I go to. I can scroll through them like it's one long web page and click on the ones I want to. I can share with other people. I can tag things so it's easy to find later. I also put my podcasts in there, so I grab the RSS feeds to all my podcasts so I can listen to a podcast within Google Reader. I also use it with an Android application where it automatically just pulls it down right onto my phone through the RSS feed, so it updates it both ways. So if I listen to it on my phone, it also marks it as read in Google Reader, so I know that I've already listened to that one.
Let's talk a little bit about that because I'm pretty interested in that. So what's the app that you use? Is it Google Listen that you use to mesh that together with your reader, with Google Reader?
I tried Listen, but I found that BeyondPod, the paid version, has more features in it and actually works better for me.
So you're pointing BeyondPod to your Google Reader feed, and it's pulling in the podcasts automatically?
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. You can set it up on a schedule where it automatically just goes in when it's on Wi-Fi and just uploads the new ones.
Interesting. Well, that adds an extra step. I currently just bring those in separately using BeyondPod, but it would be nice. Now I don't listen to a lot of the podcasts off my computer. That's just something. If I'm at my computer, I'm usually podcasting. So I mostly in the car. But another way to do it.
Yeah.
All right. Wes, you got one more thing for us.
The last thing I had here was a website I go to often, mostly just to see unique setups. It's called hardforum.com. If you go into the web page, you can click on displays, and you can see the multiple amount of people's setups that are on there, the unique different ways, different configurations. They talk technical design as far as how they're setting it up and how everything works. They've even got some of the new iFinity where you can span a single image across 3 or more monitors. And it's just a good place to get technical with PCs.
So probably for more of an advanced user, folks who want to know what other folks are doing with hardware?
Yeah. Yep.
Is that kind of how you use it? Christian, have you ever seen that before?
No, I normally use an Antec for reading that kind of stuff. But yeah, Hardform does sound interesting, so I'll have to give that a look.
Give it a whirl from a hardware perspective. Andrew, do you as you're doing a PC build, how do you kind of go about determining the parts and what you're going to do? How do you get that info?
I use the BYOB guys as a bit of a sounding board.
That's a good call.
Yeah, but I also what's it called? There's a forum called Overclockers. So I read a lot on Overclockers as well.
Yeah, overclockers.net. We get some riffraff from Overclockers that come over to BIOS Mods looking for their BIOS hacks so they can do some overclocking on non-standard PC configurations.
Yeah, and there's an Australian chapter of Overclockers as well who, for us, it's kind of useful because we don't necessarily have access to the product that you guys do as well, because we don't have your new eggs and your Tiger Direct, so often you get a good alternative if you're looking for something that's a comparable product to something that's spoken about in the US.
What is the equivalent for you guys for a new egg or Tiger Direct there in Australia? We have quite a few Australian listeners, so what?
We don't really have an equivalent that I use on a regular basis. We've got a few online sites, like there's a site called Static Ice. So if you're looking for, say, a GSD3 motherboard or something like that, you can jump onto this site, put in the part number, and it'll come up with who the best store is or the best outlet or whatnot. A lot of guys use a site called megabuy.com.au, but it really depends. A lot of people still go brick and mortar. We've got a chain out here called NSY who are one of these sites who update a PDF file on their site daily, and a lot of people just link directly to that PDF file.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a bit old school, but their pricing's phenomenal. You know, like a video card will typically be $20 to $50 cheaper from these guys.
So they go old school to kind of keep the prices down.
Correct. They've got a really basic website, but their pricing is phenomenal.
Okay. And I imagine it's direct, China Direct, basically.
No, they're all the name brands, so you can still buy Gigabyte and MSI and Asus and all the other parts, and they're a big box shipper without the big box price tag.
Okay. Oh, that's cool. Hey, speaking of overclocking, Christian, your dad kind of asked a question in chat, and he said, "Is overclocking overrated?" We hear a lot of talk, especially among gamers, about pushing the speed of their chips up. If I'm your average user, am I really going to see that much of a performance increase if I get some IT guy to come in and overclock my chip?
It's really not worth it for the average guy, because your biggest performance increase is going to be getting an SSD. That's what's going to make it look like night and day. But if you're pushing for 0.2 gigahertz, you're only really going to see something like that if you're trying to get the best FPS on multiplayer games so that you're not the one who causes the lag.
You're not the laggy.
And you can get the guy 0.3 milliseconds before your teammate does. So.
Okay. All right. Well, that gets a lot of discussion. I know there's a lot of forums dedicated to the idea of overclocking. And I know you enable the BIOS for a lot of folks that where it's not standard to allow them to overclock the chip, right?
Right. So,
And is that's both CPU and memory, right?
Right, CPU and memory, and even the chipset bus too also has a speed. It's called the AMD HyperTransport and the Intel. I'm trying to remember what the name is on the Southbridge for Intel, but they both have their respective names. And really, besides gaming too, the only really operating system speed and daily functional use, you're going to get your best speed increase with an SSD. For things like video transcoding and gaming and high-def movies, that's where you would see an increase if you have a good overclock. Now, what defines a good overclock? And that's really something that you know is cooled down enough where you have the right equipment and the right cooling where it's not a big deal to push up the speeds and get considerable performance. if the 3D benchmark Haven for 2011, if I run that on my monster box with the 6-core and push it from its standard 3.2 gigahertz configuration to 4.2, so basically 25% more of an overall clock speed than you would normally get, it does get considerably better FPS. But again, are you going to notice that when you're gaming or when you're doing day-to-day tasks? It really depends on the configuration. So for the average person, not really worth it. Go out for $150 and buy an SSD. If you're gaming, if you're really into transcoding, if you have a huge media library, either look for a higher power CPU with a large cache size or push up the FSB speeds a bit.
Okay. I think that's good advice. The SSD advice is good and fairly inexpensive. Your dad made a comment again in chat that, you know, not overclocking the CPU provides a cooler, more stable CPU. Would you agree with that?
Right. Yeah. The better the temperature is, the more it's at its stock configuration, the longer the CPU itself is going to last,
yeah.
Which includes your motherboard, because if you're burning up a chip on your motherboard, then obviously your chipset may retaliate.
Yeah. Gordon, do you have anything overclocked in your inventory there at home?
I don't. I played around with it on the first custom-built machine. Had a Asus motherboard in it, and it had a little overclocking tweaker application at the motherboard. But I didn't see a lot of physical benefit out of it. I do have my brother-in-law overclocks everything and tests it until he gets it just right and stuff. So, I don't know.
Andrew, you? Overclock?
No, I run out of the box. I haven't overclocked anything since, I think, 486DX66.
Okay.
I sort of tend to go with the thing that I'd rather just run it at, run it as it comes out of the box. If I want the performance, I'll just buy the next CPU up.
The next deal up. My boys have all built boxes in the last 2 years, and they've overclocked everything. But they're gaming, you know, hard charging. They test it and see where the temperature is and all that stuff. So they have spent some time. Yeah. I mean, they bought gear specifically with the intention of overclocking it.
Yeah, my priority more these days is to reduce the power consumption as opposed to increasing the performance.
Yeah. Yeah, I would power consumption's becoming it. Speaking of that, you've got some solar panels on your roof, right? You've had them up there a couple of weeks. How's that going? So getting some juice out of it? I know it's winter, but...
Yeah, at the moment, we're probably pulling out, on average, it's dropped off a lot in the last few days, but on an average week, we're probably generating a day's worth of power in a week. In summer, we're probably going to generate a day's worth of power every 2 days.
All right, so a seventh of your power... Is
yeah,
being
thereabouts.
Generated now and then half your power during the sunny summer months.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, it's dropping off as would be expected. It's getting cloudier and it's getting cold and you know, miserable sort of winter weather. So, you know, we're probably generating around about 20% of our daily consumption at maximum.
All right, very cool. It's good.
Good.
I'm jealous. I'd love to have solar panels on my roof pulling anything. At this point, I think we mentioned it a couple shows ago when we were talking about your panels. I've got a southern-facing roof that has no obstructions. I mean, not a tree from forever, and it just bakes. And I imagine if I covered that whole roof with panels, I could generate some serious electricity in the summer.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
It'd be
great. Although the other day, we got a thunderstorm and golf ball-size hail. I came down and it hit, when it hit the pavement, it hit hard. And I thought, anything on your roof, is going to get pounded. Although I think they're making those panels with that in mind. At this
yeah, they are.
Now, so it's not like you're putting glass up there. Okay. Gordon, thank you for your stuff. You know, we didn't spend too much time talking about RSS. Readers, if folks have, if they're using a particular reader or they've had great luck doing that, I'm always interested in how folks listen to the show. So if however you're getting the podcast downloaded and listening, whether that's through iTunes or an RSS reader of sort, shoot me an email if you would, podcast@theaverageguy.tv, and let us know how you listen to the show. I don't get the greatest statistics around that with the package that I own. I just and at the end of the show, we're going to ask for some opinions, but I just I'm always interested in what folks are using. So, Gordon, thanks for those topics.
Yeah, no,
all right. We have some new music for Christian's Corner, what we've been looking for. We're on the 30th show, and for 30 shows, we've been asking for somebody to come up with some original Christian's Corner music. And so Christian himself spent a little bit of time this afternoon putting this together. So we have Christian's Corner.
And welcome back to Christian's Corner on Thursday, June 16th.
That's awesome, Christian. Nice work.
Thank you. At 9:11 p.m.
All right. How'd you get the music? The guitar?
Yeah. So there's this really cool program called Jam Studio, which is an internet application, actually. You can launch it right in your web browser, and there are actual professional bands and album records that you can get off iTunes or anywhere else that are using Jam Studio to make their backdrops. So you literally plug in the chords, and once you have the chords listed out on the music sheet, which you can just drag and drop and change the variations of the chords, then you just drop in what instruments you want and what style of technique that instrument should play, and there you go.
So very nice.
Throw that over
very
Audacity.
Nice. I like it. I'm most impressed with the lyrics.
Yeah. You know. Original.
That was awesome. What do we got in Christian's Corner?
All right. So heading to the speed tip of the week. Now, this speed tip of the week actually turns out to be more of a conservation speed tip of the week, because even a system like mine that has a really large full ATX case and has 2 to 3 case fans that are 240 millimeter and has the really nice cooler fan from AMD, it can still get really hot in here. And not in terms of the actual temperature, but what happens is in smaller rooms and when it's really humid out, and we're talking probably a day where it's anywhere from 80 up, the RPM on your fan starts going insane slowly. And I've seen on days that we've had about 90 degree Fahrenheit temperature that it's gone over 4,000 RPM on my CPU fan, which really drives you crazy. And it's kind of strange, because you wouldn't think such a full-size case with really good cooling would have that kind of problem. But it still does maintain its temperature, but the sound from the fan and the fact that the fan quality is probably going to degrade over time if it's running at full bore the entire time, is something that kind of drove me crazy. So I'm kind of thinking, well, what can I do without really altering my normal way of doing things? So at first I thought maybe it was something I could do in the BIOS with the cool and quiet that AMD provides, but that didn't really result in anything. So the solution I came up with was using Windows 7 power options to throttle back the CPU so that it can't get over a certain voltage and a certain frequency, and all of a sudden the fan speeds were back down to a really nice RPM in the 2000 range, which is where it should be for 90 degree weather, and that made it you really couldn't tell the difference between day-to-day activities when it was running at the 3.2 gigahertz that it used to be running at and the 800 megahertz that it's running at when I put it on super conservation. So if you want to give this trick a try, you can go to your control panel and your power options, and under your power options, when you go to CPU performance, you'll see a drop down plus sign for the maximum percentage of what you want your CPU to run at. So there's a minimum and a maximum. So if you set your minimum to 5%, then that means you're probably, let's say you have a 3 gigahertz CPU, then 5% of that is going to be roughly 200 megahertz, but the operating system itself will never back down that low. Normally, the lowest you can get it to back down to is 800 megahertz. So I set my range between 1% and 30% is what it's at right now. And that keeps my RPMs not only down and keeps the CPU quieter, but I don't hear the fan at all. And I really don't notice much of a performance difference doing day-to-day stuff. Now, again, if I was probably trying to transcode something huge, I'd see a bit of a lag, but right now I'm using about 6 gigabytes of my RAM, and I have about 30 applications open on Windows right now with tabs and random applications I've been using all day, and I haven't noticed a difference at all. It's just like normally using it. So might be a good trick if you have one of those old ancient dinosaurs that sound like an air vac in your basement.
Tell me again, Christian, how do I get to that spot?
Go to your control panel in Windows 7 or in Windows Vista, and then head over to your power options.
All right.
And under power options, make sure you're editing the plan you want and hit change plan settings. And then you'll see change advanced power settings text under those two drop-down labels. And then you'll see under your plan towards the bottom, it'll be a tab that says processor power management. And when you hit that plus sign, you'll see three things: minimum power state, system cooling policy, and maximum power state. My range, even if you backed it off to half and set it from 1 to 50%, you'd see a huge decrease. And I set the system cooling policy to active. That way, you ensure your computer isn't overheating unnecessarily, because passive means active cooling means that your fan runs first and then backs off when the temperature is cool, whereas passive waits for the temperature to hike up before it kicks in. And then if you want to see the results of how your tweaking went in your power options, you can always open up CPU ID and compare the stock voltages and CPU speeds from Intel or AMD with what CPU ID is showing you. So for example, 1 to 30% on my PC, my CPU runs at stock 3.2 gigahertz. And when I'm using this percent reduction, I drop from 3.2 to 800 megahertz, and my core voltage drops from 1.4 to 1.2, which probably the voltage is really what saves you on power consumption, heat, and the noise. So it's a good summer practice.
So that might be a good vacation practice as well, right? If you're gonna leave your PCs on while you're on vacation, throttle that power setting all the way down.
Right, yeah. Cruise it at 20% and let it run.
Yeah. It's going to update. It'll do your antivirus updates. And, you know, you might even have some equipment that puts it to sleep or wakes it up or backs it up or whatever. But you would see some energy savings. You know, one of the things I might try with this is plug it into a kilowatt meter, then monkey around with these power settings and see what a difference it makes. I run a Core i3, which is pretty efficient to begin with. Really cool. Very, very quiet. I almost never hear that thing. But if you're running a more powerful processor, right, that fan can really run.
Yeah, and I can save at most probably around 30 to 40 watts by doing the reduction on this CPU. But for me, it's really about the temperature and the noise over the wattage. But I'll take 40 watts.
Cool.
Yeah. So moving on to the hardware deal, seems I've been covering every new piece of equipment we've been buying in our house, so why stop now?
That's right.
We recently purchased a Lian Li black HTPC case for our media center box. We originally had it in a regular ATX Antec case, and we had our media center with our Seton quad tuner card as our regular TV box, and we got rid of all our DVRs, and we were using that for a while. This case is one of several similar versions that Lian Li makes for their HTPCs, and this one in particular actually has almost double the width from their thinnest one, which looks almost like a Verizon set-top box. This one's a bit wider, but you get the front USB ports and audio jacks, and you get a lot more cooling in this box with the rear fans that it has and the overall airflow. It isn't as dead silent as you may think, but it's not noticeable at all when the TV is running. And overall, it's a great way to keep the PC cool and to keep a form factor that's consistent with the DVR instead of hulking around some ATX case up to your family room. So this fits like a normal like you can drop this on a glass panel display like you normally would be able to with your DVR. This one's a bit wider, but again, there's several models. So depending on what you want to build, you can do different things with it. And for us, we dropped our AMD HTPC CPU. There was a special CPU AMD made specifically tuned for media performance and low power usage that just runs great in here.
No, that's funny. Christian, the case really looks display. I mean, it really does look like it would go in a stereo cabinet with a bunch of audio equipment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, the larger one. Now, if you look down at some of the other models that they make, you can see how thin they also get. The they all start with the PC C3 series nomenclature, but their smallest one is their PC C37B is the micro ATX model. It's, I think, $20 cheaper, and you can see that's the normal size of a DVR box. Maybe a tiny bit wider, but certainly the height factor is the same.
Yeah, you know, I built a custom cabinet for our TV. You know, when we went to a flat screen, I had an area that had been a bookshelf trophy case kind of thing, and it was really only about, I think I got about 10 inches of space in there from the wall to where I wanted the TV to stick out. So I bought some, I don't know what, how deep are cabinets? 14 inches, 16 inches? I can't remember. And I cut those babies down to 10 inches so the cabinets themselves would fit in there. But right. finding the right PC to fit in there, because it was going to go behind closed doors. So mm-hmm. I needed it to be cool and efficient. And I ended up, you know, and not put off a lot of heat. And I ended up going with a shuttle case. And those shuttle cases are, you know, kind of short, stout, just stocky cases. But when you set them on their side, you know, they're about that 10-inch profile in there. And then that Atom, I put the Atom 525 in there, and that almost puts off no heat.
Mm-hmm.
It puts off some. There's a little venting out on the side. So that kind of works too, or at least that worked for me. It's also a case, that shuttle case is also one that I would not hesitate on putting on a shelf in an entertainment center and having it just there for folks to look at.
Right. So that covers the hardware and the software for tonight, and now we're going to the app, which really goes back to software anyway, but it's apps, so kind of different for me. So the app that I've been tinkering with this week is called ClipGrab, and by far the most impressive of all of these categories of apps that I've tried to use before. ClipGrab will automatically search YouTube and other common video streaming sites where you can just search the video you're looking for, and it'll automatically download it to your computer in an MP4 format, and you can queue up as many as you want to download and kind of let it download asynchronously. And it's interesting because you can either copy, like let's say you're at a YouTube site and you have the URL right there, you can just copy and paste it right in the ClipGrab and it'll download it. Or you can just search it like you would search for a video on YouTube, and it'll download it the same way. And the download performance and the fact that it's transcoding it to MP4 at the same time, it's been pretty reliable and rock solid for Windows 7 boxes that can run the MP4 codec and any other box that may have the codec extensions for MP4. But just phenomenal performance for a free application. Some of the websites that let you do things like that with copying and pasting the link and downloading really don't, they either take too long because it's on a web server and there's other people hitting it often, or there's advertisements or this kind of stuff. But this is just the cleanest, simplest application I've ever seen that gets the job done quickly. So I've tested it by searching a couple funny common videos that have millions of downloads on YouTube, and it picks it up all the time. So,
how would you, Christian? How would you apply this as an application? How would you use it?
How would I use it?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's kind of interesting, but sometimes people want to put videos that are on YouTube onto their iPod to stream and share with friends. So they do use those kind of applications a lot. Personally, maybe to do a demo on Subsonic and link it over. But overall, it's just a cool way that if there's something on YouTube you want to grab locally to take somewhere and you don't know if you're going to have internet access to be able to download that file. The most practical application I can think of at the moment that I've used it for is PowerPoint presentations where I wanted to put a video in.
Yeah, and that makes sense.
Right, and because it's under fair use copyright laws, if it's something like an educational PowerPoint or a public demonstration, then it applies under fair use, so you're allowed to embed that in your presentation.
So you would download it, convert it, and then embed it in your PowerPoint.
Right.
All right. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. I'm glad you brought that up because I have thought from time to time, how the heck do I get these YouTube videos if I want to grab something from them or create them or even edit them to put in another YouTube video of such. That must be one of the ways when they build these parodies. Bring them down, convert them, change them, whatever. Okay, that's pretty cool.
So, yeah, it's a pretty cool app.
Excellent.
I really like the download manager, too. It's almost kind of like downloading it's a really cool manager.
Yeah.
I like it.
Andrew?
Yeah, I was going to say that makes it really easy. I used to grab YouTube videos using I think it was a Flash Player Cache Explorer. Then I used to have to convert them from the Flash format across into something that was more usable. So to be able to just one click's awesome.
Yeah. All right, Christian, one more thing. You'd mentioned in there maybe you got your eyes on a phone since we just talked about phones.
I mean, I know I'm still dedicated to my HTC Touch Pro 2.
All right.
I just wanted to hear your thoughts and reactions to the HTC Evo 4G that is on the verge and everyone's kind of mouth-watering over between the 1.2 gigahertz CPU and the 720p video recording and 1080p playback and just the beautiful screen itself. It looks like a great phone.
Is that only going to be available on AT&T?
Sprint.
Sprint. Oh, on Sprint. And is that the 3D one that they've been talking about?
Yeah.
All right. Is that, Andrew, is that going to be available for you in Australia?
I think it will be at some point in time. I'm not entirely sure of the guys that they're going to bring it out in, but we tend to get everything that comes onto AT&T more so than what comes onto Sprint.
Okay.
That's for the carrier that I'm with. I'm not entirely up on what's coming through at the moment.
Yeah.
Now,
my son has an Evo, the original Evo. And he just swears by it. I mean, huge screen. I mean, that was one of the leaders in some of those larger form factor, good cameras when those came out on Sprint a year or two ago. Gordon, what service are you on here in the U.S.?
I'm on T-Mobile, and I've got the Samsung Vibrant. That's a 4-inch screen with a Super AMOLED screen. That Super AMOLED screen is amazing.
Now, that's the Galaxy S, right?
Yeah, the Galaxy S line.
Same phone as I have. On Sprint, that's the Epic.
Yeah.
And this is a 4.3-inch screen, Christian, is that right?
Yeah, it's a 4.3-inch screen.
Basically same form factor as the original Evo, right?
Yeah. Right. It's just got all the cool features and upgrades that from the original one. It's like icing on the cake compared to what the original Evo was.
What do you think? Would you move to it if that was in the right ballpark for you?
Yeah, in a heartbeat.
Did you hear that, Gary?
It's even got a kickstand on it.
Yeah, that was on the original as well. That is kind of nice. I mean, from my, you don't have the flip down keyboard, do you, Gordon? That didn't come.
No, mine's just a slate style.
The Sprint version, one of the versions has a slide down keyboard, and I do like that. Coming from the Palm Pre, I still want a physical keyboard on my phone. And so, Christian, if you're asking me, I do like all the nice bells and whistles associated with it as far as, the dual-core processor, the improved camera. I mean, it's basically, and we did a lot of this at CES, is it's basically you can do all your video recording right off your phone. I mean, why carry a camera anymore to do basic, you know, video shoots, especially we were doing demos right there on the floor and stuff.
And 720p at that.
Yeah, they're that good. I mean, it's amazing. I have noticed they're a little shuttery in dark light. Where you record from. Anyways, I don't think that's powerful enough in dark light. It's just if it gets dim at all, at least I see this on my Epic. If it gets the lens, I don't know why I couldn't think of that word. But if it gets dark at all, it starts getting grainy really, really fast. Where I know some more higher powered cameras that have bigger lens will let more light in and give you a little better, you know, resolution on that. So that's the one drawback I saw to recording video off my phone. If the light goes away, it gets more difficult. But I've been shooting tons of pictures off of my in broad daylight. I just get great resolution off the Epic. Christian, what's the camera going to be on that phone as far as megapixels?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the actual mega. I believe on the original Evo it was 8. So I'm assuming that's been either kept the same or improved.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the specs I'm looking at shows an 8 megapixel camera with the HD video camcorder. So
hey, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I don't.
That's awesome for a phone, isn't it?
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. Yeah. I don't buy the whole 3D 2D thing, though. To be honest with you, I don't know if on a phone I need 3D.
Yeah. I think I'll start with when I replace the main TV in my living room with a 3D TV. Then maybe I'll start bringing other things, accessories within the home to 3D. But until that happens,
even then, well, I'll have to stop in the Sprint store and see those. I'd like to check that out. Get one that's working. I went with the Epic because of the keyboard and not the Evo, because the Evo would have been my choice, but I really, really do want a keyboard that goes along with it. So,
and to touch on that keyboard.
You need to let go of the keyboard thing, Jim.
No, I like the keyboard. There's good application for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I came from a G1 that had the flip-up keyboard, similar to the Epic, and I wasn't sure about that because all my previous smartphones, I had a keyboard as well. But with Swipe, I can type just as fast, if not faster. So that took care of it for me. But
it's not so much a speed thing for me as it is there are times when I just want a physical keyboard to input text into the phone. It's just for whatever reason that just works better for me. I mean, I use Swipe, I use the onboard keyboard from time to time, but there are moments when I just flip that thing down and I can just fly on that keyboard. And especially helpful when it comes to editing. So if I have a bunch of text and I need to edit it, the keyboard onboard gets me a very nice pointers that I can get the cursor right where I want it. And that's always been my frustration without the keyboard is it's hard to get, sometimes it's hard to get that. Maybe that's better. I haven't done a lot of that on the phone without the keyboard, so maybe it's better today than it's ever been. I know if you press and hold, you get a little. You get a little window, and then you move that thing around to the exact spot that you want it in. But those are my thoughts on that. Andrew, what do you got for us?
Okay, this week I've got a couple of things. Where are we? The first one that I came up against, one of the guys the other day at work was talking about. His kids having some issues making sure that what they write, as in when they're typing, is what they actually meant to write, so that they get their context right and they get the speech flow and everything the way they want it to be. We were talking about it, and he was saying that an application that he's found is called Natural Reader, and what it does is any document that you can highlight text from within, it will then read it back to you in natural speech. So sort of in line with, you know, Christian training the computer to speak with the Microsoft Voice stuff. Right. This then lets you gets the computer to read something back to you in a natural speak. And it does it really, really nicely. So yeah, that one caught my eye, and we've been playing with it at work, and it's actually really good. It almost gets inflection properly, and yeah, really nice application, and it's free.
What's the difference between the free version and the $50 personal version?
Not sure. We haven't looked at that to that level, because they were looking for something that of course fit a price point.
Yeah, the price point of free.
yeah. And Microsoft have a similar. You can plug Microsoft Voice into Word and Excel and PowerPoint and what have you. But this one will, you know, allow you to highlight something in a Word document, or highlight something in a PDF or on a web page, or you know, any type of document. You just highlight it and press the play button, and it plays and it reads it to you.
Wow, I'll have to give this a try.
Really nice.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. It does look like the paid version gives you a couple more voices. So if you don't like the Microsoft voice, that's included with it, and maybe a few more add-ins that work with a variety of applications on your PC. So interesting. Well, at least you can try it for free. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And the other one that that's starting to be a bit of a bugbear for me, so I'm kind of looking for a solution, is around inbox management. So like a lot of people in a corporate world, we have an inbox limit imposed, and I tend to find at the moment that I'm pushing the limit of my inbox all the time. And Dave Allen, who's pretty much the guy who, for want of a better word, invented the getting things done concept, or seems to be the main stakeholder out there. His concepts have been brought across into a couple of applications that people I've found are using. One of them is called Simply File, which is an Outlook add-in that builds profiles around email subjects and who sends them to you and when they were sent and what attachments they have, so that you can then just go and do a one click and shift them off to a PST file, so they're not taking up your mail store. And then when we're talking about it earlier, I was having a bit more of a look, and there's a few other things out there. You know, there's a product out there called Zobni, which is free, but that's more about generating statistics about out of your email usage and who sends you email and what time of the day you receive your emails. It doesn't really give you the push it out to a PST file and manage it better. So yeah, I'm looking for something to help me. You know, I guess it's a bit of a selfish one, this one.
Yeah, you know, I've used the other inbox.
Other
inbox, and I use it. I connect it with Yahoo Mail because that's just ridiculous. Yahoo, you know, I've had a Yahoo account since 1996, and every spammer in the world knows my email address because it's just out there on everything that I do. And it works real well. It creates a handful of standard boxes for you, or folders for you, and then it starts sifting through your mail looking for what it thinks is mail that goes in those inboxes. When you get after you set it up the first time, if you get a new email that you've never gotten before from a new company, let's just say I was checking out a free version of Norton antivirus, although I never would, but say I was, and so Symantec starts sending me emails, it'll categorize those emails and then send them into a folder for me. It might put them in my shopping folder. And I control that. So if I don't want it to do that, I can go back in and say, no, this really needs to go into the bloatware folder that I've created. Thanks, Gordon, for that. And so you can kind of train the software to move those folders around. Where I found that really handy is, since I'm kind of a forms moderator over at the Home Server Show, I can train it to move all that email that I get from the forums into one box. And it just makes it a lot easier to manage the flow of information, you know, going in. I could set up a rule to do that as well. It doesn't have to, you know, necessarily don't have to use it, but it allows me some of that functionality to go in there and say, while you're at it, you know, now it doesn't, one of the things it doesn't do is it doesn't work in real time. It runs about every hour or so.
Mm.
But I've got some web tools available as well. So that's one that's worked for me, and I found it almost to be essential. You know, I could use Priority Inbox on Gmail as well, but Gmail's not my main email account.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, part of it you can do with Outlook rules, you know, like you can pick up, you know, all carbon copies and send them off to a PST file automatically, because realistically, if they're CCing you on it, then, you know, by definition, it's a courtesy copy and they don't expect to get a response. But no. then to a degree, you've still got to be able to manage that part of your inbox as well.
So I really try to avoid Outlook for my personal email. To be honest, I mean, for work.
Oh, this is my work email. Yeah, I'm talking about.
Yeah. One of the best things that ever happened to us at work was they put some some fairly restrictive limits on our email, and that, man, that's been so good for me, because every 3 months mail starts dropping off the back, and I can't get it back. I don't want it back. It's kind of forced email amnesty, so to speak, and that stuff is gone. Christian, at home. Are you web-based? I mean, I'm sure with all the business stuff that you got going on at BIOS Mods and all the other stuff you have going on, you generate a crap load of email.
Oh, yeah.
how do you manage that?
I keep everything in Outlook. I can't use webmail. It'll drive me nuts. I have about 10 email accounts in Outlook and over 5,000 emails that are stored in my PST file.
Wow.
If I don't have Outlook combined with my SharePoint calendar that's synchronizing with my phone, I'm toast.
I bet. So how do you get remote? How do you get your mail remotely when you're not at home? Just on the phone?
Yeah, either the phone, my netbook, which has the Outlook also synced the same way.
Okay.
Or I can use an application called RoundCube, which is a web interface for mail. So it's kind of like logging on to your Gmail, except it's a really nice interface, and it's ad free and all that stuff, and it's great for domain specific companies and stuff. So I've been using that for Maple Grove Partners web email access and BIOS Mods web email access for our moderators and other forum members. So.
Cool, Gordon. What's your email preference?
So at home I use Gmail, but I use the labels, and I implement a smaller form of GTD where I have the label where it's at pending reply. So if I need to reply to somebody, I grab that tag and put it on there. If it's a task, something for me to do, I'll create a at task label, and I will drop that onto that email. I've got a couple other ones. If it's just a look at something I need to look at or reference, I've got a label for those. And then just specific categories, I'll create a label for those as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly going to get to be more and more difficult. Email is not going away. as much as Twitter and Facebook have taken some of that traffic away, I don't know about you guys, but Facebook just increases my email. Both Twitter and Facebook increase my email, because I get all those notifications that, you know, somebody has liked your picture, or somebody's made a comment on your or Tim DeLejo is giving you crap about your Runkeeper. I mean, I get those all.
I get the Runkeeper crap as well, so don't feel bad.
You're welcome, Tim. So I get just a crap load. I do try and move. You know, as a practice, I do try and move those emails that I don't get or I don't really need to look at, just notifications, into their own folder that alert me that there's something new in there. And then I can choose, at my convenience, to hit the folder when I notice there's new email in there. And so that's the other inbox separates social networking email away from your inbox, which is really, really nice. So at lunch or in the evening or whatever, when I have a few minutes and I want to check my social networking stuff, I go to one folder, see in a quick scan, see what's happened in my networks, and make a decision whether I actually want to go out to Facebook or not and respond.
Yeah, nice.
Well, guys, breaking news. I just got an email. Starbucks now has an Android app that lets you pay for your coffee.
They released an iPhone one yesterday, didn't they?
Was it yesterday? I don't know. I just
I
got it. It says, now in addition to the iPhone and BlackBerry, Android users also have a faster way to pay for your coffee. And you know what? I love Starbucks, but every time I go, it's $4 or $5. And you're like, oh, it's just coffee.
You're just taking that out of the college, the children's college fund, right,
John? Yeah, yeah. It's, they probably feel like it at times, but yeah, it gets a little expensive. But they've made it easier, I'm sure. Now with this app, you just load up dollars right onto your virtual card that's on your phone, and you hit the app, and it puts the barcode, and they just scan it. I've seen them do it. Very, very convenient, but just another easy way to get your money separated from you.
Actually, talking about scanning barcodes, I was talking to the guy sits next to me at work the other day, and he's an Android user as well, and he introduced me to an app called CardStar. So for loyalty cards, you can import your loyalty card barcode into an application on your Android phone. So for argument's sake, our supermarket that we predominantly use out here is called Woolworths. And
you have Woolworths?
Yeah, we got Woolworths. They used to be called Safeways out here.
Yeah.
And I can scan our loyalty card barcode into my phone, and then when I'm at the checkout, I just run my phone across the barcode scanner. And that's this app called CardStar. So
I got to do that because I can't keep track of those cards.
Yeah, and odds are you've got your phone in your pocket. You might just have a credit card, but you can scan in all your barcodes. It works really well.
And it's just like your airline ticket at the airlines. Now you can just bring up the barcode on your phone, scan it, and go right on the plane.
Nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Andrew, put that in the show notes so I can go back.
I will.
And do that.
Yeah.
Well, guys, anything else that I missed?
No,
I don't think so. I think that's a wrap.
We've covered it.
Good stuff, guys. Remind folks that, of course, if they have questions, comments, if they'd like us to cover something on a weekly basis, they can send us an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. You can also find us on Facebook. I post the show the announcement of the show that we're releasing the show out on theaverageguy.tv out there each time. Just search for The Average Guy Network on Facebook. And you can follow me on Twitter @JayCollison, and both Andrew Christian's and Gordon's Twitter will be in the show notes. Andrew does a smashing job of getting those show notes ready each week, and I still think they're some of the best in the industry. Take a second to go out. Andrew, you put a lot of work into those. I want folks to look at them. Go out to theaverageguy.tv and take a peek at that. If you haven't been out to the site in a while, it's looking great. It's super fast. Christian has done some work to it and made it just top speed. Thank you, Christian. That's changed my life. I just want to be honest with you. There were times where it was taking, seconds in between saving things shouldn't mean that much, but when you're doing it, 100 times over, it starts to add up, and now those are just lickety-split. And you also, if you've been listening to the whole show, you also heard Christian's Corner. The new music for Christian's Corner, we're daring you to come up with something better. And so Christian gave you an example. We'll be working on that over the next couple of weeks and proving it and trying different things. And Christian, you got to send me the raw audio from that. I may make an attempt to clean some things up and add things to it.
Yeah, I need to balance back out the – I didn't really have time to balance anything. So.
No. Yeah, you work on it, or if you want to send something over to me, we can we can do some things with it as well. I'll remind folks that we do the show live on Ustream each week and live out at theaverageguy.tv/live each Thursday night at 7 o'clock. And we really fire up the stream about 6:30. Come on about 7 and get the show started about 7:30, just so you know what's going on. All right, guys, I'll do one more reminder. I'll tell folks we've got two other podcasts that we do or that I do on a weekly basis. Well, boy, they've been kind of falling off the weekly, but at least every other week we have the Fitness Tech podcast, and that one I took a little bit of a vacation from as my kids were getting married, and so we're about 2 weeks behind on that one. But Fitness Tech, where we talk about the merger of fitness and technology as well as financial tech, with Andrew Hunt, and he helps me as we talk about the latest technology issues in the financial world. Both are very cool, and if you'd like to take a peek, jump out to theaverageguy.tv. I've been getting some good comments via Twitter as well, so keep those coming. Guys, thanks for doing the podcast again tonight. If you're out in the live stream, stay around for a few minutes. We're going to discuss a little. We're going to ask some questions of the live stream that we won't include in the podcast. So if you're in the live stream, stay around. I think we got a few folks out there. Well, maybe not. We're going to ask some questions, and we'll go from there. Guys, have a good night. Thanks for coming out.
Night, guys. Have a good one.
Thanks.
He's got the loud keyboard.
Sorry.
No, I'm just kidding.
I was going to buy one of those DAS keyboards without the letters on it.
Yeah.
Except they're $170.
You know what's awesome is I've got one of these Mac keyboards. Surprisingly enough, they're, you know, the metal ones that...
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, they're USB.
They're an awesome keyboard, aren't they?
Yeah, they're quiet. They're whisper quiet. And I had a friend who worked in the shipping department for Yahoo, and they were throwing these things out by the hundreds.
Get out.
Nice.
So he grabbed me three or four, and or maybe five, and out of the five, three of them were good. Yeah, I had to toss two out. But yeah, I put one on my laptop. I put one here, and I took one to work, and they're just awesome.
Yeah, guys at work use them as well. How do you get the Windows key?
It's command. It's the right command key. Actually, either command key on there gets you the Windows key. So command L for lock, command P for print, you know, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I've been looking, but, and if you just want, like, so command E will give you Explorer, right?
Let's look. Command E. Yep. It gives you a Windows Explorer.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
I think the wireless one is perfect. It's nice and small.
Yeah, yeah. Now, well, even the wired, you know, there it's USB and it, yeah. It's just a slick looking, elegant, nice. I mean, it's a silver and white keyboard.
Yeah. One piece of aluminum.
Super quiet, yeah.
USB. Are they fast to type them?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's a USB hub, right? So you've got the two USB ports on the bottom, so you can just plug your, you know, your USB key right in there if you need to. Or
I'm gonna have to look at getting a couple of them because I'm sick of my current keyboards.
Yeah, well, they're expensive if you buy them new. I mean, I think they're $70.
$50 out here.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So there's my endorsement of an Apple keyboard.
I got the Microsoft. What is this one? Microsoft Comfort Keyboard 5000, and there's little feet that you can put on the front or the back of it. Yeah.
I like got the same one.
I forgot the package that when I bought it from Best Buy was missing a feet in it, so I called Microsoft and told them they sent me a whole new keyboard.
Really?
So I have one at work now and one at home.
I've got the Dell one that comes in the box.
Yeah.
which is a Logitech, and that's the noisy one.
The crappy cheap one. That, you know, one of the things I like on keyboards is when they put a padded, or I don't know what you call that, but where the feet are padded, so that it's not that plastic against your desk, you know, that it holds a little bit better that way. So those are nice. Okay. We'll have to add that to the show. We had a little keyboard talk. Okay, 30, and today's the 16th. Here we go.